I had another lesson I was going to do because I didn't want the women to miss out on any of these lessons. But the lesson seemed okay, but I felt like, no, you know, I'm going to continue because the bottom line is we only have one more Wednesday before the semester ends. So a lot of you won't even be here. Some of you anyway won't even be here. So I thought, no, we're going to continue the series, and the ladies can go to the church website or my website and get the audio. So we're going to talk about supposed contradictions in the Bible. Now, for some of you who are younger Christians, you don't even realize the stuff that's out there. Mm-hmm. All right, and one way to avoid it is just never go online and never listen to a bunch of critics. But that's not realistic. At some point, somebody's going to say, "Oh, that's all the Bible, this and all this sort of stuff." So my job is to prepare you. By the way, I can't handle every possible supposed contradiction tonight. There's a book, it's out there, it's called All the Contradictions in the Bible.
Wow.
It's this thick. I read it. It's this thick. Well, why I read that whole book, I don't know. It was written by a believer and it goes through every one that, you know, anyway, if you go to my website, I have a question and answer section and I've answered over 3,000 questions, and the most common category is this. I would imagine you'll find 600 or 700 questions like that. All right? So we're going to talk about it. Now, here's our outline of doing Christian evidences. It seems like a lot, but we actually covered 4 of them last week. Messianic prophecies, claims of Jesus, miracles of Jesus. Well, we didn't do the resurrection because we ran out of time. Existence of God, we did that. My intention next Wednesday is to go over inspiration and the whole how we got the Bible, the canonization of the Bible, and that sort of stuff. We did history, archaeology, and the Bible. I want to do science and Christianity. We may have to do that after the semester ends, although Merced College will still be around. All right, and then we'll talk about answering the hard questions. That's another area, okay? Now, remember, we put these kinds of Christian evidences into 2 categories. Those which can be used in sharing our faith. Those are the kinds I get excited about. And the ones that are necessary for Christians to learn about, because the critics of Christianity are going to throw it out there. So these are intended to defend your faith. All right, like I said, nobody's going to become a Christian because of the Tell Dan inscription. All right, from 2 weeks ago, okay? Similarly, by the way, in 2 weeks, we're going to be in Dublin, and I'm going to go to the library. It is the library that has the most 2nd and 3rd century manuscripts anywhere in the world. It's right there in Dublin. I don't know if Jen finds that interesting. I just drag her over there anyway. I don't know. It's like a kid in a candy shop.
Is the second most transcripts?
No, the most. The most manuscripts from the 2nd and 3rd century anywhere in the world is in a collection right there in Dublin.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're going to go there.
Can you actually read them? Or no? They're just there?
Well, I don't read Greek. They're all Greek.
Well, I mean,
it's Greek to me.
You
can look at them. You kind of go, wow, that's so cool. I know, for a lot of people, whatever. By the way, the oldest, the Rylands Papyrus, that's in Manchester. It's at the Rylands Museum. It's in Manchester. And, oh, man, when I went there, I was like, whoa. Probably for a lot of people, it's like, whatever, you know. Piece of papyrus, you know. But, hey, it's from roughly 130 A.D.
Wow.
Or 125 plus or minus 20 years. I mean, that's crazy. Anyway, so this evening's topic is to defend our faith rather than an evangelistic topic. Okay, got it? So here's the claim that you'll see, and people will put this out on the internet with great confidence. This is absolutely the case. By the most common perpetrators of these claims are Muslims. Okay? The reason is this. In the Quran, Muhammad says, without any possible alternative interpretation, that Jesus was not crucified and that he is not God. And also there's some other stuff. And so if the Bible is true and reliable, then Muhammad is a false prophet. So Muslims claim the Bible has been corrupted. But also contradictions. All right, so anyway, claim of the skeptic. The Bible is full of obvious errors of fact and of doctrine. In other words, there are contradictions of information that can't possibly be resolved, but there's also contradictions of teaching or doctrine, all right? And which is proved by all these contradictions it has with itself. Therefore, conclusion, it is not inspired or authoritative in its content. If that were true, wow, that'd be a problem for us as Christians, right? Now, there's two ways we can react to these kinds of challenges to our faith. One way you can react to these challenges to our faith is to say, well, you know, I just believe God, I trust God, and, you know, I'm just going to ignore those people. All right?
Yeah.
But I believe problems shoved under the rug come out at the worst possible time. So these doubts, these things that you shove under the rug, they just stay under there. They're just sitting there. And then something happens in your life, you know? Your girlfriend breaks up with you. Or, you know, God allows something into your life that's kind of hard to accept that God would allow that in your life. And suddenly, out it pops. So I propose solution number one is a really, really bad idea. So number two then is to consider, listen carefully to the criticism of the Bible and ask yourself, is this an actual contradiction? I propose it's a much better approach. Okay? And I believe this. I've suggested this many, many times. When you hear stuff, let's say even just reading the Bible, you come across something, you kind of go, wow, that doesn't sound right. There's something, I don't know about that. Keep track of these questions. And I believe as a young Christian, that list, at least for the first few months, maybe even the first couple of years, that list will actually grow rather than get smaller, which can be a little bit scary. But as you do what I propose that we should do, which is chase these things down, try to find possible resolution, talk to the experts, you know, ask reasonable questions, I believe eventually that list will get shorter and shorter and shorter. And at some point, I've reached the point in my spiritual life, when I hear people say such and such, I go, okay, well, there you go again. And it's not like I'm not listening to them. I give this example. I believe the Bible deserves the benefit of the doubt at some point. At some point. Just like with archaeology and history in the Bible. At some point, the Bible deserves the benefit of the doubt. So when you hear stuff, you kind of go, all right, well, we'll find out about that, but I know what's going to happen. The illustration I would use, let's say somebody said, hey, I saw Jan hanging out with some guy.
Some guy?
Yeah, right. And, you know, and, all right. One thing I know is whatever it was, it's not she's being unfaithful to me. I mean, I'm sorry, but that explanation is impossible.
Yeah.
It is impossible. And for me, and the inspiration of the Bible, I reached that point a long time ago. A long time ago. And we have to be careful of presuppositional thinking. If you have a presupposition in answering a question, in theory, that's philosophically a bad thing to do. But I'm sorry, my presupposition that my wife is faithful to me, I don't feel bad about that anymore, you know what I'm saying? And so I've done enough things that, sure, I listen respectfully, but I kind of know where we're going on this thing. You know what I'm saying? All right, so types of contradictions that we'll consider. Number one, identical events, for example, say in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, or say Mark and Luke, or even in some cases, things that are recorded in the New Testament that reflect especially the Stephen's speech in Acts 7, that are described by two different authors, have details of fact that appear to contradict. Okay? So when we see that, for example, in one place it'll say 700, another place it'll say 7,000. Well, it can't be both. Okay? Number two, claims that a doctrine which is taught in two different passages is in contradiction. Look at that. Those are more squishy kinds of things. And then sort of under item one, but numbers of objects, people or years in two different passages do not agree. Do you like the little picture there?
That's
yeah, that's a good one. Okay. So, questions to ask. How to approach these kind of things? Right. Is this a legitimate contradiction? Most of the time, and I'll show several examples, where people so confidently claim there's a contradiction, you simply read the two passages and you go, what are you talking about? You make, generally these things are coming from people who don't even know the Bible. And therefore, they don't even understand what's going on. Okay? So is there a reasonable and obvious explanation? This is usually the answer to all of these things. Is there a chance that there was a scribal error that could account for the discrepancy? Especially in Old Testament things, the New Testament, we have a 99.such-and-such% reliability on this, on the text. But with the Old Testament, it's more like maybe 98% reliability. In other words, I'll talk about that next week. I'll just give one example. In the Jewish number system is more like Roman numerals than Arabic numerals. Okay. All right. With Arabic numerals, we don't use letters for the numbers. We use numbers for the numbers. And so in the Jewish system, the letter that's used for like a 5 and the letter that's used for a 7, well, I'll show, they're actually kind of similar. Besides, all right, let me give an example. We got two possibilities. Which is the correct one?
The top one?
Obviously! Which is the correct one?
The numbers?
I don't know. That's the point. So, it is quite common for there to be copying errors in numbers in the Old Testament. Alright? So that's another possible explanation. Alright? I believe, that the autograph manuscripts, in other words, the thing that was written by the inspired writer is without error, is inspired, and is without error, inerrant. But we acknowledge that copying errors do occur. Okay? Number three, is it possible the two passages, rather than contradicting one another, actually complement one another? Now, this will be going back to number two. Claims that a doctrine was taught in two different passages is contradictory. It's possible that the two work together rather than against each other. Whereas, perhaps, the first time we read it, kind of go, yeah, that is confusing. Okay? So. Good. So, let's look at some, by the way, all these come from my website. And I've got others, alright, other lists here, okay. All of these come from people that sent letters, questions to my website. Here's an obvious contradiction. Alright? So let's just look at some of them. Alright, Genesis 7:17.
Alright.
Now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna ask you smart people, which is everybody in this room, of course, if you can figure out what's going on here. Genesis 7:17. Obvious contradiction. Obviously, the writer doesn't know what they're talking about. By the way, the critics say there were at least two, but probably three different flood stories with massively different details, and an editor put that into one story. The Eloist and the Deuteronomist, there's all this stuff out there. Okay. Genesis 7:17. Zane, please read that.
Yeah, here we go.
Genesis 8:3. Garrick, please read that.
For 40 days the flood kept coming on over, For 40 days the flood kept coming on the earth. And as the high waters increased, they lifted the ark high above the earth.
Okay, great. Genesis 8:3, Garrick. All right, so people say in Genesis 7:17 it said the flood lasted for 40 days. In Genesis 8:3 it said it lasted for 150 days. Contradiction. Help me out there.
Well, receded steadily from the earth at the end of that amount of time. It said that it flooded this date.
Right.
And then it receded and went down
right.
at this number.
So when a lot of rain comes down, it produces flooding.
Yeah.
And when do the rivers reach their maximum height? Well, if you live in the Midwest, you know this. Here in California, we don't have floods, you know. We don't have, all right. So I remember the flooding that happened in the Midwest in 1992, 93. And the floods kept rising for at least 2 weeks after the water had fallen. Because we're on the Missouri River. It's way downriver. So it rained for 40 days. But the water didn't recede for 150 days. So much for a contradiction.
Right.
All right, here we go. All right, Genesis 37:36. Let's see. Evan. And then Genesis 39:1. Andres. Genesis. And again, people are saying, obviously the Bible writers, obviously both are not true because they completely contradict. Genesis 37:36. Evan, Genesis 39:1. Andres, go ahead, Evan.
Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard.
Okay, good. So Midianites sold Joseph. Okay, Andres?
Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was once a Pharaoh's official, captain of the guard, brought him to the Ishmaelites.
All right, 39:1.
Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
That might be translated as Ishmaelites.
Ishmaelites. So was it the Midianites or was it the Ishmaelites? Who sold Joseph into slavery? Was it the Midianites or was it the Ishmaelites? I've got a question for you, Alex. Are you Californian or American? All right. Right, because the Midianites were Ishmaelites. All right, there were many Arab tribes. There were many, many Arab tribes. So, you know, again, proof the Bible is not inspired by God.
But what's the nation of, what is it, Midian?
Yeah, Midian, the Midianites were Ishmaelites.
Okay, so that's like their nation, but then their ethnicity is like the Ishmael.
Yeah. Sure, I guess so. Or... Again, are you Californian or American? American, bigger category. Californian, smaller category. Ishmaelites, bigger category. Oh, okay. Midianites, smaller category. Okay, got it? Yes.
I mean,
it would be like, are you a Jew or are you a Benjamite?
I see.
Yeah.
Hmm? I mean, either way, he was sold to Potiphar. That.
Right, that, but again. But again, they're saying, I know that, but the person's saying, look, was it a Midianite or was it an Ishmaelite?
Yeah.
Contradiction.
Yeah.
They're not claiming the contradiction.
For me, it'd be, well, was he sold and to whom?
Yeah. No, you can't do that. You can't do that.
Why not?
Because either it was...
Never answer the question. I pose another question to them.
I know, but you can't do that. I'm telling you, not to a skeptic. A skeptic's not going to buy that.
Yeah.
Jesus did it all the time.
It's either a Midianite or an Ishmaelite.
Never answered those Pharisees.
And the answer is both.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Yeah, sure.
Like I said, pushing the supposed contradiction aside
yeah.
is not going to solve the problem. For you, you don't care. Okay. Okay. Fine. I get it. I agree with that.
No, I care. But
I'm saying you don't. I'm saying you don't care. Right.
Was sold and to a man that doesn't contradict who he was sold to.
Nobody ever said it did.
In Egypt.
Nobody ever said it did. The contradiction is who did the selling?
Exactly.
Was it a Midianite or an Ishmaelite? The answer is yes. Got it?
Yes.
All right, here's another one. Matthew 27:5.
All right.
Matthew 27:5. Matthew 27:5. Since you're going to mention it, why don't you read Matthew 27:5 and Acts 1:18, Josh Borges. Matthew 27:5 and Acts 1:18. By the way, my hesitation was, some say Amalekites, others say Ishmaelites.
Okay.
All right. For the Genesis 8:3.
So
anyway.
Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself.
Right.
Okay. So how did Judas die?
He hung himself.
Okay, Acts 1:18. Josh Borges.
With the payment he received for him, his wickedness, Judas bought a field. There he fell headlong. His body burst open and all his intestines spilled out.
Okay. Yeah. So which is it, says the skeptic.
Yeah.
All right, what do you think? Anybody? Alex knows.
Is it both again?
Yeah. If you were hung and your body hung for a couple of days in the hot weather and you were cut down, what do you think might happen? Fall head down, yeah. Again, but I'm telling you, the critics of the Bible put this stuff out there for unthinking, unprepared people as proof. Alright, so you gotta be aware when you read these kind of things. Let's do another one. John 19:17. All of these came to my website from unbelievers who are telling me, why do you believe in the Bible? Look at this. Alright, just, you know. Probably a couple of these are coming from believers who are just all shaken up by what somebody told them. John 19:17. I don't know. Ken, I guess maybe it's your turn. And Mark 15:21-23. Michael.
Verse 17. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, so Jesus carried the cross.
Yes.
Okay.
A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross.
Right. So one gospel says it was Simon that carried the cross.
Yeah.
Another gospel says it was Jesus that carried the cross.
Is it split? Yeah.
Yeah. Alright? And I'm telling you, I've seen people declare with great confidence that one of these authors is clearly wrong. Okay? So which is it? Yeah.
In the movie.
Okay. In the movie. No, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Right. Right. Obviously, for somebody who's not disingenuously looking for a reason to reject the Bible, this is so obvious, right? Remember I gave different categories? Alright. Identical events described by two different authors have details of fact that appear to contradict. Alright, so we did a few of those. Okay, let's go to the next one. 2 Samuel 8:4. This one's a little bit tougher one. 2 Samuel 8:4. Actually, I'll deal with that one because you have to use your little marginal note. Let me see. So who's going to do 1 Chronicles 18:4? We'll read that one first. Volunteer to read 1 Chronicles 18:4, Ken. And I'm going to read 2 Samuel 8:4. And by the way, 1 and 2 Samuel cover the same material as 1 Chronicles. And then 1 and 2 Kings cover the same material as 2 Chronicles. So the possibility for a contradiction is rife. The question is, are there any? All right, so I'm doing 2 Samuel 8:4. Yeah.
David captured 8,000 of his chariots, 7,000 chariots, and 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses.
All right. Let me see. Meanwhile, David defeated Hadadezer, son of Rahab's, king of Zobah, when he went to restore a monument at the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots. All right. And let me see. 1,700 of his charioteers. And 20,000 foot soldiers. So which is it? 7,000 charioteers or 1,700 charioteers? Now, they can't; those can't both be true.
Yeah.
So what's the explanation?
Maybe it was the character release.
It's a number thing.
It's a number thing. It's a copying error. Okay, you weren't here, Josh, when I explained why number copying, especially in Hebrew text, is problematic. Number one, the Hebrew number system uses letters as opposed to, you know, like Roman numerals. And some of the numbers are, there's like, who thought of that, you know? All right, it's like H and B or something like that. They're kind of similar. All right, so almost certainly, by the way, so, the Dead Sea Scrolls have 7,000, but the Masoretic text, which is the generally considered the most authoritative Hebrew text, has 1,700. Yes?
But isn't the Old Testament and New Testament inspired by the Holy Spirit, so shouldn't it be perfect, like without any mistake?
Exactly. But nobody claims that the copyists were without error. In fact, if you want to claim the copyists were without error, you're going to be wrong in instantaneously. Okay, we know that errors were brought in through copying. And it just so happens the most common copying error in the Old Testament is with regard to numbers for some common sense reasons. I can talk a little bit about more about this next Wednesday. We could talk about the manuscript issues that are in the New Testament. We'll talk about different kinds of things like wisdom is proved right by her deeds versus wisdom is proved right by her children. We'll talk about stuff like that. So I am fully convinced that the manuscript, the autographs of the manuscripts are without error and are inspired by God. However, we all know that copying occurs, and God chose to use humans. And because in the case of the Old Testament, we have roughly 8,000 Hebrew manuscripts. In the case of the New Testament, we have roughly 5,800 manuscripts of Greek. And there are differences in the manuscripts because of copying errors. And some of them are obvious, like a spelling error. Or there will be things where two words got transposed. There'll be sometimes two lines are repeated. And there'll be sometimes a line got skipped.
The New Testament, isn't there, just recall that there's a number but no verse.
That's next week.
Okay.
Go ahead, Alex. Go ahead.
Not off topic, but why do you think God made us in a way like where we make mistakes?
That were because He didn't make a machine. He made it. Yeah. Yeah. Next Wednesday, I'm going to read what the Talmudists said about how to make copies and what the Masoretes said about how to make copies. And these guys were crazy. And they were so careful and legalistic. I mean, anyway, we'll talk about that. Let me say this. Some of this, just for tonight, because that's next week's topic, Alex. Let me say this. Some of the supposed contradictions are because of copying errors. Okay? And to deny that would be to be wrong. Either that or maybe the Bible is not inspired and it's got errors. I mean, the original. We're going to add something?
Next week, are you going to hit John 8?
Yeah, John 8 and John 5 and 1 John 5 and Mark 16, all those things, yes. Yeah. Okay. So I say actual contradiction. In other words, the first four, they weren't contradictions, right? They were not contradictions. The fifth one, I mean, if you look at the Masoretic text, it is a contradiction.
Yeah, why is it called?
Because of the Masoretes. So, okay. All right. So, the bottom line is we have very few really, really, really ancient Hebrew texts for the simple reason the Jews had a law where the old manuscripts were to be burned. All right. They didn't bury them. They burned them. And therefore, the oldest Hebrew manuscripts we had before the 1940s was the Leningrad Codex from like 895 AD. So, you know, from around 900 AD, that's a big time gap from 450 BC or whatever. All right. But And so what happened was, in the late 9th century, the Jewish scholars around the world got together and created a unified text. So today, scholars get together with all the Greek manuscripts, and they create sort of a Greek text based on all the manuscripts that people can use for making translations. Well, that's what they did with the Hebrew text, roughly 900 AD. And so from then forward, everybody used that corrected, you know, scholarly Hebrew text throughout the Jewish world. Well, that's great for them, but it's bad for us. Because what it did was it eliminated all the variant readings, which we have with the New Testament. For example, wisdom is proved right by all her children, or wisdom is proved right by all her deeds, and we can ask logical questions, which was probably the original. But if you get rid of all the variants, then you don't have this ability to study all the texts and ask almost certainly what was the original. So the Masoretic text was an awesome scholarly attempt to create a unified Hebrew text. But luckily for us, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And those were manuscripts that were copied between about 250 BC and 50 AD. And those give a different viewpoint. But we also have the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation. It's like a snapshot. And the Septuagint translation was made around 200 BC. So although it is a translation, it's a translation of what was an accepted Hebrew text from 200 BC. So we have three lines of evidence. If you read your footnotes in your Bible, say that Masoretic, DSS, Masoretic, whatever. And also there are other sources, like there was the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is a translation made 500 BC. All right? Which is only the five books. Okay, so we have all this evidence. So, anyway, the Masoretic text, which is almost all the Hebrew manuscripts, almost all of them have the 1,700 or whatever. Now, your Bible actually says 7,000. The reason is, scholars get together, they make logical questions, they ask probably what was the original. Well, they look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they look at the Septuagint. Generally, the Masoretic text is more authoritative. All right? But given the information in 1 Chronicles 18, and given the Dead Sea Scrolls and the other sources, they say they put 7,000. All right? Good. All right, contradictions in doctrine. Exodus 24 through 5. I've actually gone over this one not that long ago, in talking about the question of pain and suffering. Exodus 24 through 5, verses Ezekiel 18, 19, and 20. All right, so let's go there. I'm going to do this sort of quickly, because there's so many other examples I want to take a chance to look at. Exodus 24 through 5. All right. Who's going to read Exodus 24 through... let's have Josh read Exodus 24 through 5. And let's have Josh number 2. Sorry that you're number 2, but you are. Yes, tonight, next time you'll be number 1. Could you please read Ezekiel 18, 19 through 20? Okay, let's let everybody get there. All right, I'm going to do the Ezekiel one. I know what they both say, but... All right, Josh, are you ready? All right, so visiting the iniquity of the father to the children and to the grandchildren to the fourth generation. Got it? Josh Borges. Ezekiel 18, 19, and 20.
Yet you ask, why does the son not share the guilt of his father? Since the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to keep all my decrees, he will surely live. The one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them.
Okay, so this is item three. This is the third category. Okay? And I'll have to say, a simple reading of Exodus 24 through 5 and Ezekiel 18, 19 through 20, clearly, one says they will be held accountable, the other one says they won't. I mean, that seems to be a clear contradiction. Seems to be, but it's not. In fact, I believe the two complement one another with an E, not with an I. Okay, because Exodus 24 through 5 is talking about the consequences in this life. In other words, people who do sin bring suffering on themselves and on their descendants. And if somebody beats their wife or their children, that's the way it goes. So Exodus 20 is talking about something completely different. It's the moral law that says sin brings suffering. Sin brings consequences. And then Ezekiel 18 is talking about the eternal consequences of our sin. And before God on Judgment Day, this is justice. Exodus is talking about what happens, okay? And Ezekiel 18 is talking about justice. And justice says we are only responsible for our own sins. So the sin of the Father does not bring consequences in the Son or vice versa. Got it? No contradiction. Okay, Exodus 20 verse 8 and Isaiah 1 13 on the Sabbath. Exodus 20 verse 8.
Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy.
Okay. And then Isaiah 1 13. Ken? Right. I hate your Sabbaths. And observe the Sabbath. Which is it?
Both.
Yeah, I mean, and with these kinds of things, ask yourself, because I believe they're both true, but ask yourself, which is the more fundamental truth of the two? Which is the more fundamental truth of these two? They're both true, but which is the more fundamentally true? No, Ezekiel. The Son does not bear the guilt of the Father, neither does the Father bear the guilt of the Son. That's justice. That's what I would say. All right? And basically God says, if your heart is not right, if you're in sin, don't waste your time with your ungodly worship. God's not happy with their Sabbaths. But God wanted them to observe the Sabbath. Ephesians 2, 8 through 9 says, we're saved by grace through faith, not by works. Right? Right? And James 2, 24 says, we're not saved by faith apart from works. In fact, works, faith without works doesn't save you. Which is true. Both true. Which is the more fundamental truth? That we're saved by grace through faith, not by works? Or that faith without works does not save us? Which is the more fundamental truth? The first one, for sure. We're saved by grace through faith, not by works. What kind of faith? Well, faith that does not include works is not saving faith. Okay? Here's one of my favorite ones, Proverbs 26:4 and Proverbs 26:5. This is a fun one. This is a fun one. By the way, because it's in Proverbs, arguably it can't really be a contradiction, because Proverbs are just sort of human wisdom, that inspired human wisdom. All right. But I've had people say this is proof that God's all confused. Proverbs 26. Verse 4. All right. Let's see. Evan, Proverbs 26, verse 4. And just for fun, we'll have Garrick read 26, verse 5.
Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes.
All right, God, help me out here. Should I or shouldn't I answer a fool according to his folly? The answer is, it depends. It depends. You know, sometimes to even take part in the conversation is to make a fool of yourself. Other times, you answer a fool according to their folly, and then it makes it obvious what's going on. Hello. All right.
How's it going?
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Really quick, on the second row of contradictions, both of them were correct?
All right. Every claimed contradiction should be taken on its own merits. Okay? So, for example, in 2 Samuel 8, verse 4, in 1 Chronicles 18, 4, they're not both correct. They're not both correct. Okay? They can't be. 2 Samuel 8, 4, David took 700. Or 1 Chronicles 18, 4, 7,000. Let's go back to this. We're talking about, I don't know what the original said. I don't know which the correct number is. Whether it's 700 or 7,000, I don't know. But remember this example. Which of these two is correct?
The top
one. Obviously.
Yeah.
So if somebody were to make a copying error, it would be corrected. Which is the correct number? I have no idea, and I have no context to even decide which is the correct one. So let's say the Greek text has been copied again and again and again. And again, and again, and somebody accidentally either adds a zero or takes away a zero. I don't know which happens. I don't know. I don't know which happens. How do you know which is the correct one?
You don't.
Okay? So that's the explanation there. Okay? Alright, here's a good one. And honestly, I've looked into this topic hundreds of these things. Hundreds. And 90% of them, like, of these supposed contradictions, like, oh, come on, give me a break. I mean, this is not a contradiction. You just either don't know the Bible and don't have the ability to even really think about it carefully, that or you're disingenuous. You're just looking for reasons. But every once in a while, there are things like Exodus 18:4 versus Ezekiel 18, which is like, wow, that's a good one. In fact, Christians have debated between Ephesians 2:8 and James 2:24 for centuries, which they shouldn't do. Big mistake. All right? But here's a good one. Luke 9:3. Let's do Matthew 10:10. Matthew 10:10, which, by the way, is the same as Luke 9:3. Matthew 10:10 and Mark 6:8. All right, Matthew 10:10. By the way, what we're doing is that we're doing a series of Christian Ephesus classes. We're dealing with this claim that the Bible is full of contradictions.
Oh, I see.
And I cannot address every claim of a contradiction. What I'm doing is these all came to my website. Mm. Oh, by the way, do you see the picture there? It's a good one. It's a contradiction.
Oh.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, because it's two different
things. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Who did I ask to do, Matthew 10:10? I didn't ask anybody. Okay. Michael. And then Mark 6:8. Garrick.
No bag for the journey or extra shirt or sandals or staff. The work is worth his keep.
So how many staffs should you take?
No extra shirt, sandals, or staff.
No staff. Okay, good. All right, so which is it? Take a staff or don't take a staff?
Don't take extra staffs.
Oh, see? See, this one bothered me. We got this,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the answer. It's the answer. This one bothered me for weeks when I first read it. It's like, it took me a while to figure it out. All right, so here we have a brilliant genius who figured it out. Correct. All right. Solution. A closer examination reveals that the account in Mark 6:8 declares the disciples are to take nothing except a staff, which a traveler would normally have, whereas the account in Matthew states that they're not to acquire another staff. There is no discrepancy between the texts. Mark's account is saying that they may take the staff that they have, but not an extra one, while Matthew is saying that they should not take an extra staff or tunic. All right? Good. All right. Here's one. Let's stop reading them because we only want to go about 5 more minutes and I want to do examples. So in Luke 8 and Mark 5, it says that there was, that Jesus healed a demoniac, a person with demons, a legion. Whereas in Matthew 8, 28 through 34, it mentions 2 demoniacs, 2 people.
Yeah.
All right. So which is it? 1 or 2? The answer is probably it was 2. But both Luke and Mark mention only 1. This is the one who was occupied by many, many demons. The one who had been breaking his chains. The one out of whom the demons were driven and sent the pigs into the water. So they just don't mention the second one, who was also healed. He just had a little demon problem. So is there some requirement? In fact, here's the deal. Often there are minor differences between the 3 synoptic gospels. Yeah. Right, of course there are. Because if there weren't, then why even have 3? So these are 3 separate eyewitness accounts. If you have a trial and 3 witnesses come in and they say the exact same thing, you know they talk to each other. Mm-hmm. You know it. But if they come in, I remember, because I've been on 3 different juries. I have the bad luck of being on 3 different juries. And I remember there's this one thing where the guy came and kind of did the thing with the knife and this girl and all this sort of stuff. And the witnesses had wildly different accounts. They really did. But I remember getting back in the jury room and we're kind of going, you know, but we thought about it. No, it wasn't contradictory. It's just that, you know, they were remembering different details. All right, so here we go. Are there 41 generations from David to Jesus, as is mentioned in Luke, or are there only 28 generations? So basically, David says this person, this, and there's 41, and in Luke, there's only 28. All right? And the answer is, well, you have to know how Jews did genealogies. They would skip generations. If they said, such and such is the father of such and such, that could mean grandfather, it could mean great-grandfather, it could even mean great-great-grandfather. That's just how they did genealogies. And specifically in Matthew, he's doing 7, 7, 7, 7.
Yeah.
Now there's this period of time, and he chose 7 of them. And then there's this period of time, he chose 7 of them. And because of the number 7. But people who don't know how Jews did genealogy would say, well, there you go. Alright, did Saul kill himself, 1 Samuel 31, or did an Amalekite soldier kill him? Alright. Well, Saul asked the Amalekite soldier to kill him. Alright? The way 1 Samuel describes that is, Saul killed himself.
I thought it was like, he told his servant to hold his sword so he could run.
Right. That's right. And so, and then, yeah, exactly. Not a contradiction. Alright? Did Satan incite David, or did God incite David? That's a big difference. 2 Samuel 24 versus 1 Chronicles 20. Did Satan incite David to do the census, or did God? That's a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
The answer is God allowed Satan to incite David. That's what happened. Okay, and all right, et cetera. We could go on. I'm running out of time. Okay, you can read those. This, I posted this on my website, at our church website. You can get all these notes. I always post all the notes. Just if you don't know where to find them, ask me. I'll tell you. Okay, got it? But this one, on first read, it's like, wow, that's definitely not the same. God and Satan are definitely not the same. But if you read Job chapter 1, Job chapter 1 kind of explains 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21, mm-hmm. where God allows Satan to do stuff that really was what God wanted to happen. Okay? Let's see here. So, Matthew 2:23, where it says, it was prophesied that Jesus would be called a Nazarene. And that people say, there's no prophecy anywhere that Jesus would be called a Nazarene. And yet, if you look in Isaiah 11, 1 and 2, and Zechariah 6, 9 through 15, it says, Jesus will be the branch. And Nazareth is a place. But the fact is, the word Nazar means branch. So Jesus was born in Branchville, basically. Or Branchtown, or whatever.
Branchburg.
Right, no contradiction. What about the genealogies in Matthew and Luke? If you look at the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, you go, how could you possibly... The fact is that Matthew is the genealogy of Joseph, and Luke is the genealogy of Mary, because that's how the Greeks and the Jews did their genealogies. In fact, if you look careful, you'll see Joseph, the son-in-law of Heli. In other words, it's the genealogy of Mary. He mentions Joseph because all the things... So, no contradiction. Matthew 1:23 says the virgin will be with child, but if you read Isaiah 9, it says the young woman will be with child. So, what is it? A young woman or a virgin? Well, I don't know. If you read Isaiah 9, it says, behold, God will give you a sign. A young woman will be with child. So obviously she's a?
Young woman. Virgin.
A virgin. Otherwise, how's it a miracle?
Yeah.
Okay. Etc. So here's my conclusion. And then you could take it for what it's worth. If we allow for the fact that there have been small but significant errors in copying, Alex, I could tell that threw you a little bit. Possibly. Maybe a little bit. So just think about it. Just think about it. If we allow for the fact that there have been small but significant errors in copying, and if we think carefully about what is taught in the Bible, and if we give the benefit of the doubt to the unclear cases, in other words, if somebody accuses you of being corrupt, the benefit of the doubt goes that you weren't corrupt. In other words, they have to prove you were corrupt. And if they don't prove you were corrupt, then you weren't corrupt.
The burden of proof is on
them. The burden of proof, correct. Correct. If we give the benefit of doubt in unclear cases, there is literally not a single true contradiction in the Bible. Question or comment?
Can I ask about a contradiction?
Sure. Why? Because it's the inherent, inspired word of God. I'm done. I'll take questions now.
This one's bone grease.
All right. Right.
Then in Mark, it says that they were eating in the house of Simon the leper.
Right. Those are two different stories.
Two different stories?
Right. If you, yeah, because the one is basically at the very end of his life. Right. So.
Leper can't be a Pharisee, though.
So the Luke one happened fairly early. It's in the Galilean ministry of Jesus. Yes? He's in the home of that Pharisee. What's his name?
I don't think it says the name of the Pharisee, but.
Alright. Alright, let's go to the actual passages. All right, so give me the first one.
Yeah, okay.
The one happened in Bethany, and basically this was Jesus being anointed for his burial, essentially.
This one, yeah, this one's Jesus at Bethany. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised.
Right.
They gave dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was on the reclining table. Mary therefore took a pound, expensive ointment, made from pure nard, anointed
and Judas wasn't so happy about that.
Yeah, Judas wasn't happy about that.
No.
Sure. Yeah.
Let's look at the Luke one. By the way, if you guys have examples of this, send it to me. Okay? Or even go to my website.
One of the Pharisees asked to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house to reclining at the table. An old woman of the city was a sinner, which was an idiot, and he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house. An alabaster flask of ointment, standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair off her head and kissed his feet.
There's almost no details in common between these two stories, because these are two very, very different things that happened. One happened in Galilee, the other one happened in Bethany near Jerusalem. One involved going into a Pharisee's house and a sinful woman, which certainly is not Mary. All right, you got that? So these are two different incidents.
Then why is the other one also at Bethany, Matthew 26, at the house of Simon the leper?
All right, let's go there. Matthew what?
26:6.
All right. So these two are the same story, okay? So the Luke one is a completely different situation, all right? And that Jesus got anointed, the other one wasn't even an anointing, really. See you later. Okay. All right. But clearly the Matthew and John ones, is the other one from John?
Yes.
Yeah. Those clearly are the same event. So, yeah. So there you go. So this is Matthew 26. While Jesus was in Bethany in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar, very expensive perfume. I assume that's the same person as in the John one, right? What's the John reference? We need to finish up here, guys, so this will be our last example. Because I try to finish by as close to 8:30 as possible. Yeah, apparently it was at Simon's house. Does it say it was at their house?
Yeah.
It just says in Bethany. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So now we know where it was, whose house it was at. Okay?
Times or just one time?
No, the Luke one happened much, much earlier in his ministry. He's in Galilee. This is a, in quotes, sinful woman. And Mary was definitely not that, that's for sure. In fact, almost none of the details match at all. There's virtually no overlap whatsoever. Well, the one is doing his feet. The other one, I believe, is doing his head. You know, there's no overlap. But the Matthew and the John one are the same story. The only difference is that Matthew gives the additional information of whose house it happened at. Okay? There you go. Excellent.
Thanks for sorting that out.
So, conclusion. Those who say the Bible's full of a bunch of contradictions don't know what they're talking about. Either that or they just haven't thought carefully. There are no contradictions. Not that I found. My favorite one was solved in 5 seconds. The staff. One, it says don't bring an extra staff. In other words, don't take extra stuff.
How many times have you read the Bible?
Five billion times. I've actually probably only read it like, okay, I'm going to read it from cover to cover probably about 5 times.
Five
but,
times?
But I've read the whole Bible many more times than that. What I mean by this is, I've said, okay, I'm going to read the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of
all right. Right. And so there might be some place in the Bible I've only read 8 or 9 times, possibly. Maybe. I don't know. The other parts I've read dozens of times. Some people like to read through the whole Bible every year, and that's great. That's great. That's not my thing. I've read through the whole Bible systematically about 5 times. More or less. And all of those, you know what, it might be time for me to read through it again, because it's probably been like 30 years since I've done that. Might be a good idea. Alright, there are 3 accounts in the Bible of a woman pouring out perfume. One of them happened in Galilee, fairly early in Jesus' ministry. It was a prostitute, or a woman, sinful woman, in the house of a Pharisee. Completely different thing. No connection. None. The details don't match in any way whatsoever. Poured on the feet, poured on the head. Mary, not a sinful woman, home of Pharisee. Okay. The other two, he read them and he thought, well, there's a contradiction. It's at Lazarus' house and then it says it's Simon's house. But if you read them, one says it's at Simon's house, the other one doesn't say what house it's at. Right. This is a typical way these contradictions work out. Josh number one. I just want to get some time together, but total flexible to your schedule.
Would you be able to do Sunday after service?
Yes. Right after?
I think all day Sunday.
All right, we will do it Sunday after worship, whether it'll be right after church or not. I think it's Cinco de Mayo, and Jan and I are committed to going to a lunch. But in order to make this happen, I will work around you. In other words, I'll come here. Okay. We'll just find a time. Yeah, I just want to get some hangout time. I know it's finals, so I can't expect you to be flexible. Totally can't. So I totally get that you could do it today. How are you doing, though?
Pretty good.
Good.
Yeah, mainly just that coding project. That's kind of...
Yeah, I was a little disappointed you didn't make church on Sunday, honestly, but, you know. It's all right, you know. It's okay. Yeah, but anyway, that's a pretty intense project, huh? Are you feeling like you're going to get it done on time now?
I think so.
Good, good, good.
It's a MATLAB project.
Yeah.
And I'm not too familiar with MATLAB, more so Python, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, so I can't help you at all. If it was a physics thing, a chemistry thing, a biology thing, even an English thing, even a history thing, but I'm absolutely zero help to you. Now, is it the independent kind of independent study where if you got help, it would literally be cheating anyway?
I mean, the professor, he says that you're not allowed to work with anyone else.
All right, so that's just the way it is. Nobody can help you. So, all right, we'll just pray for you. All right, yeah, good. Be there on Sunday, please. If you need a ride, let me know. I'll get you. Okay? Good. It's good talking to you. You're awesome. Are you turning down a ride? What, Secret Hitler?
Like that board game.
Is that a...
Yeah, it's a... It was at the retreat going on, but I don't like to play Secret Hitler. I like to take it there, and I'll rearrange it to, like, say, Secret Jews.
So how are you? Are you set up for finals? You feeling good? You looking good?
Yeah, we're both feeling good. Evan's feeling good. I'm feeling good.
Good.
We're all ready for finals.
Excellent.
All right, well,
I'm going to give Evan a
you make it to, all right, if you make it to church on Sunday, you might have packets for our students.
Packets for sure.
Yeah, all right. All right. See ya.